So thanks for coming, everyone. This is going to be a bit of a whirlwind panel. My name is Max Wilbert. I live near here, just outside Eugene. And for the past several years, I've been working on several issues in the Great Basin and the Intermountain West. And I grew up in Seattle, and I know it's really easy for Westsiders to forget about anything that's happening east of the mountains. People tend to think that it's empty, there's not much going on out there, but there's a lot going on. It's incredibly beautiful. It's very biodiverse. But because it's so easy to overlook, it's become sort of a sacrifice zone in a lot of ways. So this panel is a bit of a grab bag of some friends and contacts who I've met over the last several years who are working on some great issues in this region. And so we each decide we'll take about 10 minutes and talk through some of these issues, and hopefully we'll have some time at the end for some Q&A and discussion amongst us. So I'd like to go down the line first, and we could just have each panelist introduce themselves, if that's okay with you all. Could you start, Jennifer?
I'm Jennifer Isla. I'm from Shoshone Paiute Tribe's Duck Valley Indian Reservation of Nevada and Idaho.
I'm Laura Cunningham, Executive Director of Basin Range Watch, and we're based in Beatty, Nevada, southern Nevada.
I'm Kevin Emmerich. I'm also part of Basin and Range Watch. I'm one of the co-founders, again, based in Nevada.
My name is Chris Zinduff. I'm a homemaker. I'm a writer. I used to work for the National Park Service, and I live in Elkton, Oregon, not right now, hopefully for a while.
Cool. It's a really good sign when it goes blue like that. Okay, so I'm going to start, and I'm going to stand just because I can't project very well when I'm sitting. So my work in the Great Basin, I'm going to start, and then we're just going to go down the line, I guess. So my work in the Great Basin began about 5 years ago when I moved to Salt Lake City. And I was new to town. I was trying to get a handle on the political issues in the area. And so I was attending meetings. I was checking out different groups. And my friend Michael, who lives down in Moab, Utah, sent me this article to read from the City Weekly, which is the weekly paper. And this was my introduction to the issue called the water grab. For a few decades now, Las Vegas has been running out of water, and they've been looking to the north for water. So they're planning to put in a series of wells and a 270-mile pipeline from eastern central Nevada all the way down to Las Vegas. So here's a map of what this looks like. The amount they want to extract is huge. It's on the order of 225,000 acre feet per year. This would come from more than 200 industrial-sized wells. The pipeline that would carry the water would be 8 feet in diameter. And this is in the middle of a desert. This area has no rivers. There are a few streams, but there's not too much water out there. It's a very dry place. This is Tubrit, which is also named Mount Moriah by the white settlers when they came. And this is a 13,000-foot peak in Great Basin National Park. It has a glacier and groves of bristlecone pine. And for those who don't know, Nevada is just chock full of mountain ranges from 7,000 feet maybe all the way up to this height and higher over in the Sierras. And in the area of the water grab alone, there are 5 or 6 wilderness areas. And these wells would be put in place basically surrounding the national park and all of these wilderness areas, sucking the water out from underneath them. So this is where the water would come from. There's a lot of snowfall in these mountains in the winter. This is a spring storm, actually. But there are some really beautiful creeks that come out of these mountains, and that's the water that they want to take. So they, like I said, they plan to put wells on all sides of the national park and suck it out from underneath the park. And there's a lot more going on in this region as well. This is called the Shoshone Cedars, or the Swamp Cedars. It's a biologically unique grove of Rocky Mountain juniper trees on the floor of Spring Valley. And this is an isolated population. There are 39 mountain ranges in Nevada, and there's only, and these trees occur in Rocky Mountain junipers, and they only occur in one valley, and that's here in Spring Valley. And some botanists believe that these trees are speciating, becoming a whole new species. It's a really beautiful place, these springs bubbling up, and you have wildflowers in the spring. And because of the water and the shade, this has been an important gathering place for Goshute and Shoshone people for thousands of years. People would gather here to plan pine nut harvests and to gather and meet and mingle. And it's also a sacred ceremonial site. And because the Goshute and Shoshone people would gather here, it's also a very tragic place. There were three massacres at this site. The biggest was in 1863, and it's believed that about 300 people were killed by the U.S. cavalry. And the last massacre took place in 1897. And my friend Delaine Spilsbury, who's a member of the Ely Shoshone tribe, her grandmother was one of two little girls to survive that massacre. They were 10 years old. So this is a very important place for a lot of different reasons. And this is the headquarters of the... First time I went to the headquarters of the Confederated Tribes of the Goshute Reservation, this is the first thing I saw driving up. SNWA is the Southern Nevada Water Authority. That's the Las Vegas water utility. And they came up with a new acronym for it. So my friend Rick, who's Delaine's son, he says, water is life, and SNWA intends to take it. So we don't have a ton of time to discuss this issue further, but the current status is that it's a fight in the courts. It's a long-term struggle. The legal victories have been on our side for now, but they're not necessarily going to stay that way. It doesn't look like this pipeline is going in anytime soon, but all that needs to happen is for them to change a few water laws, and it could go in. So another issue that I've been working on in this region is a little more time sensitive. It's taking place right now, and that's around pinyon juniper forests. These are pinyon pine trees, and these are juniper trees over here. Some combination of pinyons and junipers is the dominant forest type across a lot of the Intermountain West. You can see this distribution map here. And you can find forests dominated by these trees from up in Idaho, down all the way into Mexico, and from the eastern slopes of the Sierras all the way into the Rockies. And in a big chunk of eastern Oregon as well. So here you have old growth juniper. It's really difficult, if not impossible, to actually age these trees, but a tree like that could easily be 800 years old or more. This is a Utah juniper, but you also have Rocky Mountain juniper. There are quite a few species of pinyon pine across the region. This is the single leaf pinyon pine. And these forests are important in a lot of ways, but among the reasons is pine nuts. These have been an incredibly important food source for humans for thousands of years. A pound of pine nuts is 3,000 calories, very nutrient dense. And when one forest or mountain range isn't producing well, the next one over often is. So over on the right here, we have juniper berries. These aren't a food source per se, but they're a very powerful medicine. There's a lot of medicines that come from the juniper tree. So people talk about the pinyons and junipers being your food and medicine right there from those two trees. And these trees don't tend to get much respect because they're not big, they're not magnificent like the forests are out here. I think they're magnificent, but most people don't. And both of these trees can live to be up to 1,000 years old. It's pretty rare with pinyon pines, but one was found that was 963 years old. And these make up some of the biggest tracts of remaining old-growth forests that are probably left in the entire country. And not many people know about that. You look, you know, you go on these forest protection organization websites and look at maps of remaining old-growth, and they don't even show any forest in Nevada whatsoever, let alone these big swaths of old-growth forest. So it hasn't been... Oh, there's my phone ringing. That's embarrassing. It hasn't been easy for these forests. The first major insults started in the 1860s when the mining industry really took off across Nevada. Up here you have a charcoal kiln, and this is a mine outside Virginia City. And you had huge swaths of trees being cut for charcoal and for timber. And a man named Ronald Lanner. He wrote the book on pinyon pines. He may be the world's expert on them. He cites accounts of the destruction around Virginia City, and he says, quote, "When mining began in 1859, the mountains for miles around were covered with pinyon and juniper. A typical yield of pinyon pine was 10 cords per acre. The furnaces of Eureka could in a single day devour over 530 cords of pinyon, the produce of over 50 acres. After 1 year of major activity, the hills of Eureka were bare of trees for 10 miles in every direction. By 1874, the wasteland extended 20 miles from town, and by 1878, the woodland was nowhere closer than 50 miles from Eureka." And for me, I think it's a key point that oppression is always tied to resource extraction. So as these sources of food and medicine were destroyed, the indigenous people of the area became dependent on these wage jobs, mostly in ranching and logging. And then when the mining industry collapsed in the late 1800s, the pinyon trees were mostly gone, the grasslands were fenced and overgrazed, and the old ways were kind of lost in a lot of ways, or at least beaten back a lot. So unsurprisingly, given how this culture operates, a similar thing is happening today. This I first learned about this a few years ago when a friend named Myron Dewey, some of you may know him from live streaming from Standing Rock, he was one of the people doing that, he started sharing these photos of 70 acres of a traditional harvesting area near Sweetwater, Nevada, that they went out to harvest their pine nuts and the trees were just gone. And here's some more pictures. This is one of the elders who's been fighting this out there. And the Forest Service said this was a mistake, but it wasn't a mistake because they're doing this exact same thing on a massive scale throughout the entire Intermountain West. We're talking hundreds of thousands of acres. The BLM, the Bureau of Land Management, is the main driving force here, but I think this issue circles around some of the major trends that we see in our culture today. It's ranching, and you look at white supremacy, and you talk about people like the Bundys out there in Malheur, and you know, circling back to Trump, it's sort of all linked together. It's part of the same mindset. So today, the dogma of the Forest Service and the BLM is that these pinyon juniper forests are encroaching on lands that they don't normally occupy, and this is based on their computer models, and which have a lot of flawed assumptions often. And they also accuse these trees of using too much water. And both of these arguments have been soundly defeated in the scientific literature, and I'm happy to give you some references at the end of the slides here. But these trees are actually not encroaching, they're recovering, because they were clear-cut extremely heavily, like we said, in the 1800s, the mid to late 1800s. So these forests are coming back. That's what they're doing. And I think they're being scapegoated. So this is chaining. This is one of the ways how they take down these forests. They take an anchor chain from a battleship, and I think there's a lot of tragic poetry in that. They hook it between two bulldozers, and they just drive it across the landscape and rip down everything in the path. And what's left behind is a total wasteland. They're doing this all over the place. They also use poison. They spray herbicides. They cut individual trees by hand. They use machines called masticators, which basically just chew up the entire tree into wood chips. Two projects I learned about just this week, 47,000 acres in Navajo County and 100,000 plus acres near Prescott, Arizona, both in Arizona. And they're doing this in Eastern Oregon as well. And I think it's insane to think that a practice like chaining can actually improve the habitat, which is what they claim. These treatments are, they call them treatments, enhanced interrogation techniques.
Spelled differently, or?
No, treatments, just normal, they call them
an
treatments.
What do they do with the treatments?
Different things. They'll sometimes use them for biomass, which I think Chris is going to talk about a little bit.
I'll get to that.
Sometimes they let people take them for firewood. Sometimes they pile them and burn them, or sometimes they just leave them on the ground. Some people estimate that these lands that have been chained could take 5,000 years to recover, because the Great Basin is so fragile. So they tell us that no old-growth forests are going to be cut, that it's only these young trees. But you go out there and you see it with your own eyes, and it's not true. This is on Spruce Mountain, a couple hundred acre destroyed area that we walked through. And this is a juniper that was, that other beautiful juniper in the first slide that was so thick, that was you know, right behind me when I was taking this picture. So you have this beautiful old growth forest, and then on the other hand, you have, side you have this. And this was a juniper tree that was, you know, something like this big around. They're slow growing trees out there. So I want to close with a quote from Murray Morgan from 1955, because I think it encapsulates how most people think about trees in this culture. The quote is, "It was strangely like war. They attacked the forest as if it were an enemy to be pushed back from the beachheads, driven into the hills, broken into patches, and wiped out. Many operators thought they were not only making lumber, but liberating the land from the trees." And the key to me with this is that I don't think there has to be any emotion involved necessarily in hatred. My friend Derek Jensen writes that any hatred that's felt long enough no longer feels like hatred. It feels like economics, or it feels like the way things are. And I think that's the situation that we're in. You have this very dispassionate justification for destroying these forests that's full of holes, but when you actually see what they're doing out there, it's just laying waste. So, in closing, for the past 5 years, I've been organizing a trip out here to this area in eastern Nevada. It's extremely beautiful, and the trip is called the Sacred Water, Sacred Forest Camp, formerly the Sacred Water Tour, and it's taking place over Memorial Day weekend, just outside Great Basin National Park. We'll be visiting some of these sites and discussing strategy and sharing skills and information with each other. And it's an amazing place. It's very wild. It has some of the darkest skies in the lower 48, as this picture shows. And I think it's really important to get out there and just fall in love with the land. And that's what will lead us to fight for it. So, again, that's May 27th to 29th. So talk to me if you're interested. And that's all I have.
Okay, so I was just going to talk about the Tesla Gigafactory and some of the things that are going on in Nevada right now. The lithium-ion batteries Tesla opened their Gigafactory earlier this year. They just chose Nevada. There's a location in Story County just outside of Reno where they're building their Gigafactory. Can we make this big?
It's big up there for them.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So it's not complete, so it looks like this, but they are pumping out product. And it's not exactly, you know, what it's presented to be. There's a lot of collusion going on with the Nevada Minerals Commission. There's a lot of tax breaks going on with the government. It was actually funded, like the Nevada lithium supplier was funded under the Workforce Reinvestment Act in 2009, and BLM has like $28 million allocated for the Nevada mine, which is down by Tonopah, Nevada. So they're getting government subsidies to develop new extraction techniques. Right now, most of their product doesn't come from the United States. It's comes from overseas. That's, what is that? Okay, that was their early plans for Tesla, but they promised a lot of jobs, and there's not that. I think there's only 300 people working at the Gigafactory right now. They promised 6,000. Their only local lithium supplier is Chemtailfoot Abermarle, and it's down by Tonopah, Nevada. It's called Clayton Valley Lithium Mine, Silver Peak. It used to be hard rock mining, but in the 80s they got a permit to spill out brine from deep geological aquifers onto the flats in an alkali valley. Kind of a contained basin, but they've been pumping out about 38,000 acre feet a year from the deep geological aquifers and just like having settling ponds in the valley. So that's their only local supplier in the U.S. And Chemtailfoot was also a Cold War era weapons handlers, so they left a lot of waste in Pennsylvania and North Carolina. There's another lithium source or processing place in North Carolina, but the lithium itself comes from overseas. So the rest of the batteries are the three things they need most to make it is cobalt, lithium,
water.
No, not water. Graphite. So those are being imported mostly from China, but the cobalt comes from the Congo, so it's a conflict mineral. There's a lot of human trafficking, child labor. You know, the Congo's got their warlords and arms dealers, and it's where blood diamonds come from. So that was one of the reasons for the Dodd-Frank Act, and you see that Elon Musk is now Trump's advisor, so the Dodd-Frank Act was just repealed by executive order recently because Tesla has been called out lately for the past couple of years, like, where are they getting their materials from? And they haven't disclosed it. Even Apple, Panasonic, the other companies have disclosed the source of their materials, but Tesla just doesn't want to do it. They don't want to answer. So Amnesty International has been doing investigations. There's a really good series that I cited about the lithium is coming from South America, from Bolivia, Chile, Argentina. The indigenous people in the South American Alps are just being polluted. They're even their stock water, they've been dewatered so much that they just, you know, they herd their animals, and they don't even have water for their animals anymore. It's just really been destructive, and that's Albemarle is the company that's in Chile right now. They're the biggest lithium supplier in the world. They're also in Australia and other places, but that's one of Tesla's suppliers. So there's a really good series in the Washington Post about Albemarle, and they did a three-part series about the cobalt from the Congo, the graphite from China, and usually all of this is purchased from, you know, Chinese buyers, you know, get it to China, and then it's imported from China, so it kind of loses its place in the materials supply. So back to Nevada, Silver Peak Lithium has been in business for about, I think they've been in business over 50 years, but they started spilling out their water onto the flats through the brine. They pump up the salt brine and they process it, they refine it right there, and now they're looking at extracting through geothermal sources, and then they want to refine it and re-inject it into the groundwater aquifer. But the aquifer under Clayton Valley is already contaminated. It's pretty closed off from the rest of Nevada, but they don't have any drinking water. There is a historic mining town. It was a silver town originally. There is a lot of new mineral claims in Nevada. I think there's been over 10,000 since 10,000 unpatented mining claims filed with Nevada Division of Minerals since, I want to say, the beginning of 2015. So they've got claims in Big Smoky Valley, Monte Cristo, Fish Lake Valley, Teals Marsh, Columbus Marsh, Clayton Valley, Alkali Lake, all the way up to the Black Rock Desert, into southern Oregon, up by Fort McDermitt. Some of those placer claims are, there's placer claims, and some of the lithium claims have up to 25% uranium royalties being paid, so they're actually planning on sucking out uranium through the groundwater aquifers and refining that with the lithium. So I think you know, the laws for public lands aren't suited right now for them to do that, but Nevada is working on changing those laws, and so is BLM. So that has a lot to do with the land transfers to the state of Nevada that American Lands Council is lobbying for. I don't know what that will do to tribes if you know, because Nevada doesn't have any kind of trust responsibility to Indian tribes. So the water rights are an issue because, you know, all the surface water in Nevada is owned. Nevada is in charge of the groundwater aquifers. So there was a law coming out that there was draft legislation. It was a Nevada Assembly Bill 52 where they were going to make some geothermal water rights available for development on BLM lands. And now Albemarle has come in and they have senior water rights and they don't want that, so they're lobbying against it now. They were okay with it last year until some of the other companies wanted to get in on it too, but now they want to monopolize, so they're lobbying against it. And they're filing against everybody's exploration permits. So there's the water rights issue. Let's see, Congress, Mark Amade has introduced legislation to, it's called the Critical Mineral Development Act. It's for energy infrastructure, including pipelines across BLM public lands. It allows for some of these wells to be developed inside of wildernesses and the infrastructure installed, and then they would transfer that over to the state of Nevada. There's some new language in the Department of Defense Defense Act, and they're trying to change dissolved minerals so it's available under fluid minerals like oil and gas extraction. So these are all new laws that we haven't seen yet. There's not laws in place for well casings for brine wells It's just the whole permitting thing is not regulated to be done on this scale. The Clayton Valley site was like one site that was permitted for Department of Energy back in the 50s. So it was never intended to be a statewide operation. They're also looking at the Salton Sea. They have some claims over by Moab, Utah. Wyoming kind of dropped out of it. They were looking under the oil and gas fields down by Rock Springs, Wyoming, but they've kind of backed off on that. I'm not really sure why. But the whole presentation of you know, Tesla, the Gigafactory being, you know, a clean energy alternative is really, you know, when you start looking at what it really is, it's pretty shocking. So, just letting you know.
Okay. Yeah. So, I'm going to switch out. I was going to talk about some energy extraction issues in the Great Basin in Nevada, but this has sort of been breaking news for us. There's been a trend for big military base expansions in California, and now they're going to be hitting Nevada really big. And so, this is something we're jumping on, but the Nellis Test and Training Range has a lot of live firebombing in certain areas. Here's a map. It's a huge area of southern Nevada, north of Las Vegas, and it goes almost all the way up to Tonopah. And from Beatty, it goes all the way to, not towards Caliente, but in that direction. So they want to take 227,000 acres in that green area on the right, which is in the Desert National Wildlife Refuge. They co-manage the red, you can see that red part, is the Desert National Wildlife Refuge. And the black is the Air Force Test and Training Range, Nellis. The purple is the atomic test site. So we got a lot of overlapping land management there. But the Air Force now wants to expand and take more of the public part of the Desert National Wildlife Refuge. which to us is just ridiculous. They also want to take this little square on the south part near Indian Springs, and then 17,000, almost 18,000 acres of BLM land right near where we are, and the headwaters of the famous Amargosa River, which is flows underground sometimes, but right in the headwaters. So this came to our attention really recently, and it's a strange new process that Basin Range Watch has not seen before. It's a legislative environmental impact statement that's in the scoping process right now. And what that means is the Air Force is the lead agency. It will withdraw land from Department of Interior. Fish and Wildlife, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service runs the Desert Wildlife Refuge and BLM land. So, but the decider in this, usually like an EIS, an Environmental Impact Statement under NEPA, the record of decision is signed by like the head of Interior. This is going to be decided by Congress. So Congress will actually take all the NEPA review and make the decision at some point. It's early in the stage right now. This is the Sheep Range, which is all beautiful public land right now inside the Desert National Wildlife Refuge. And most of what you see in that mountain range will be enclosed by military if this happens. The Desert National Wildlife Refuge, 1.6 million acres, a lot of proposed wilderness. It formed for management of desert bighorn sheep, and it has one of the largest populations, 600 very healthy desert bighorn sheep there, and a lot of other wildlife. Now, we attended a poster session from the Air Force where they had a lot of poor maps that they haven't really been putting online very well. So these are my photographs of posters, but all these little dots, like the purple dots that you see there, are records of desert tortoises. And this map is highly inaccurate because they're showing almost no purple dots in the area that they want to enclose. They're all on the outside. And that is false because I actually worked as a biologist inside the target areas, inside the present military base, where they do a lot of these live fire exercises. And I have never seen so many tortoises in my life. It was like there's no dogs, there's no disease, there's no people collecting tortoises, and there were nests and eggs and babies, and so there actually are a dense purple dot core areas within the military land. So this is an inaccurate map. Some of the other maps they show, they have these bombing ranges, and in the north, up on kind of the top upper left part, is near Tonopah, and they have sort of an indiscriminate area of a big basin where they just do a lot of live fire bombing. And in the south, these white polygons are what they can do now. They have these very specific targets, and I worked on one of those there that has it's a strange area that they weld together metal shipping containers into buildings. I even drew some of it. No cameras were allowed. So this is inside the present target zone in the Nellis Test and Training Range, and they had like the old hull of a C-130, This was 7 or 10 years ago, so I think it's a lot bigger now, but they would have the palace built, you know, construction of metal containers. And then next would be the hospital, right? So they were trying to strategically target certain structures without hitting others. But what they want to do, the main target is that long white polygon on the left, and they want to bomb that more. Right now, they just kind of do a limited amount of live fire targeting. And so what they think they need is a big buffer over what is now public land, over the sheep range, and that's that sort of lighter green area. That's sort of what they initially wanted to just take. We're going to take, and that's in the Desert National Wildlife Refuge. Here's another sketch of some of the more minor live fire exercises inside this target. I was just drawing when I was a tortoise biologist out there. But what I think they want to do is use bunker busters now in this target. Like they often
this is a kind of a bad picture, but they'll drop these bigger bombs and try to explode bigger targets. And I was talking to the Air Force and saying, well, why do you need such a large buffer? You're going to take most of this mountain range that's in public land. And they said, well, modern warfare has gotten more advanced. And what they want now, that on the left, they can only fly in and drop their ordnance from the north into that target. And what they want to do now is to be able to fly in any direction 360 degrees higher and faster. And what I think they want to do is drop that big bunker buster onto a target. But they say that they have misfires, and so they don't want any public in the wildlife refuge. And they also have shrapnel. Apparently, shrapnel can fly 10 miles over a mountain range into public land. So they just want to, this is all what they say is for safety. So that's just some of their posters talking about the bomb safety footprint, complex warfare requirements. It's actually really sad because they not only want to do bigger live fire bombing over the Desert National Wildlife Refuge with all these bighorn sheep, but they want to make new roads and put these cement pads where there are nothing now but wilderness, where they will build these electronic warfare emitters for complex electronic, you know, countermeasures. You know, they'll pretend to have the enemy on the mountain range and sending electronic signals to mess up their bomber runs. But right now, this is just remote wild habitat for bighorn sheep. And they want to have roads. They want to have new cement pads with beacons. They want to have very fast, probably B-1 bombers or other aircraft flying fast and low and dropping big bombs into an area, which they're not going to do any live fire in the area they want to expand into, but they're going to have like Humvee training and all sorts of other things. So right now they fly in almost from Utah and do the big bunker busters in the northern range near Tonopah. And the down in the yellow is they want to expand their big, high, fast bomb live fire exercises in the southern part of the range where the Desert National Wildlife Refuge is. And then to jump back really quickly, I'm almost done, but this little, the R77 expansion there, that little tiny part on the left, that's actually the headwaters of the Amargosa River. And I have a picture of it. Well, I took the picture out. But it's just a beautiful area of Joshua trees and remote desert. And what they want to do there is fly their drones, which are now based at Creech Air Force Base, fly over the Nevada test site and do live Hellfire missile bombing in the headwaters of the Amargosa River. And so they need another buffer for us public who might be hiking or whatever in BLM land, which we do a lot. It's a beautiful area of Joshua trees and desert. There's desert tortoises. So we're not too happy about them wanting to take more BLM public land and closing it off. So in case, you know, they have a misfire or shrapnel, we don't think they need to do any more military expansion tests. So if you go on our website, www.basinandrangewatch.org, we have all of this information there. Like if you would like to comment, there's the scoping process is just opening. We have like what alternative you should support. And it's the status quo, like don't change anything. Because otherwise, right now you go and you hike into this, up the Amargosa River and you hit a sign like this. And there's not there's like a little gate, but you could walk through it. I mean, it's pretty mild, but if you kept going, you eventually will meet with patrol and they'll, you know, take you back out. So it's just will be a complete removal of the public from another big section of public lands. So what can we do? We're shortly going to be doing a letter writing campaign and phone call campaign to Congress. And if you want to sign up for our newsletter, just go to our website and we have a newsletter sign up form and we'll at some point in the next month, probably be sending this out for just stopping the military from expanding more over public lands. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. I'm Kevin Emmerich. I'm also part of Basin and Range Watch. Thanks for inviting us to this. I'm actually following the lithium mining, too. I'm pretty worried about that, so you gave me some new info. And we're really following the PJ forest reduction as well. We really oppose those. But what we've been doing a lot as a group since about 2008 is following and opposing a lot of these what I would call sacred cow renewable energy projects. And we love renewable energy, I want to make that really clear, and we just think it needs to go in the right places. And the pure intention of creating big solar energy is good. It's to reduce carbon emissions, it's to help stop climate change. But when you get these really large corporate companies behind it, the environmental impacts of these projects kind of go on the back burner. And so what I want to do today is give you guys a history of what we've been following since 2008 through some photographs. I'm calling this before and after. And this is not all of the projects. There are many, many. There are only five in this presentation. But it'll give you a good idea of why we had a problem with a lot of these. And we support solar and rooftops over parking lots and brownfield and disturbed areas. But these locations are problematic. And so, let me come on here. I don't know how that got so small. That's supposed to be a lot bigger. So I hope this, something's definitely gone wrong with this. These are not supposed to be this small. But we are we just became a nonprofit organization. We started out as a volunteer group back in about 2008. Nobody was following these real flatlands that we were looking at. And so when there was a renewable energy rush, we got really concerned. Now, why are we concerned? Okay, this is a little bit better. You can see this slide. How big is the average large-scale solar energy project that's built out in the desert? A lot of people thought we were overreacting at first when we got a little concerned about this. They say, well, what's the big problem? It may be just the size of a football field. Well, a football field is about 360 feet long, 160 feet wide. You take some of these really big large-scale solar energy projects, and they're looking to be about 7,500 acres, 4,000 acres. It can take literally about, it's 2 miles of driving to get along a dirt road from one side to the other of one of these projects. So they can have pretty big environmental impacts. Okay, here's a brief history of solar energy and renewable energy on public lands. There are a lot of solar projects that are built both on public and private land. I'm going to focus on the public land ones in this presentation because that's where I have some of the best photos. I won't go through all of this. This would be tedious, but renewable energy, large-scale energy transmission has a pretty long history of being approved and talked about in the desert southwest, whether it's California, Nevada, starting with President Carter. He had the Department of Energy, and he had his National Energy Plan, and this pushed for some of the first large-scale energy plans in the west out here. Moving up, I'll just go in 2009, under the Bush administration, the Interior Secretary put out a secretarial order to put 10,000 megawatts of these projects on public land. And then in the Obama administration in 2013, upped that to 20,000 megawatts. So, thank you for that. Well, that really got messed up there. There should be more on that picture here. I'm sorry about this. We started to hear a lot of terms like fast-tracking, smart from the start, streamlining from the government. That map is a picture of solar applications located in the Amargosa Valley, Nevada. And in 2009, it was literally covered with it. There were like maybe 30,000 acres worth of big solar applications just in that part of public lands on the desert. We started to get other planning, like when they say smart from the start, they came up with the Solar Programmatic Environmental Impact Statement, which in 2012 resulted in the creation of 6 solar energy zones, 17 solar energy zones in 6 western states. And these were created to put the energy in parts of the desert where they thought it would have the least impact, and then to streamline that approval. For example, instead of an EIS for a big 2,000-acre solar project, we just get a 30-day environmental assessment because the review was done smartly in the beginning. We also started to see the desert, we saw the approval of the Desert Renewable Energy Conservation Plan, and that was created in 2012 in California, and it created millions of acres of conservation area, but freed up 400,000 acres of public land for streamlined large-scale energy development, and that's a lot of undeveloped land. Hopefully the next one will be better. So, okay. This is the first one that I'm going to talk about. Now, this is the Great Basin panel here, and a lot of these photographs are going to be in the Basin Range province that goes south of there in the Mojave Desert. But I think you'll get the idea. We're following a lot of projects in the Great Basin, including the Spring Valley Wind Project, the Crescent Dune Solar Project, the Transwest Transmission Line, the Luning Solar Project. But this one's located down south of Joshua Tree National Park, and this is called the Desert Sunlight Solar Project, Riverside County, California. We went down there in 2010, walked around this site. It's a 20,000-year-old desert pavement, microfill woodlands. Those are desert trees with bipinnate leaves, and it's an arboreal desert. This is about 4,600 acres. This is the before, and they replaced this with all photovoltaic panels. And this is a massive project that goes as far as the eye can see. None of that desert pavement is left. None of those microfill woodlands are left. This project was very huge. It got a loan. Here we have some problems with the text again. It got a $1.8 billion Department of Energy loan, this project. And so when they got that loan, they just started bulldozing the desert. They completely cleared the desert. They cleared it so quickly they had fugitive dust problems. When these projects were all approved, they used a technique called adaptive management, which basically means approve now and mitigate later. And we ran into a lot of problems when they started doing that. This company needed to use 50 more acre feet of water for dust control, and they couldn't control their dust. Well, they're getting it out of an aquifer that's fossil aquifer, it's ice age water. And so when you extract that out of the desert, it doesn't come back until you go into another ice age. And then we have the lake effect. If you see this middle photo right here, a giant sprawling photovoltaic solar panel project looks like a lake. And birds are deceived by that look, and they have been noticed, like they hit buildings. Well, you put a big flat building in the middle of the desert here between the Colorado River and the Salton Sea, you get birds hitting solar panels. And they have found a lot of dead birds under this project. And that one on the left there, that's called a Yuma clapper rail. There's less than 1,000 of those left. That's a federally endangered species. Some of these are killing birds. Next one. Okay. At least these are coming out. This is in Nevada. This is called the Dry Lake South Solar Energy Zone, an 1,800-acre project called Playa 2, Clark County, Nevada. It's basically a large upland Mojave Desert habitat. Before, here's what it looked like after scraping. A pretty dramatic difference right there. So this particular project here is, it's like I said, in a solar energy zone. So they only reviewed it with an environmental assessment, and they missed a lot of things. The fact that it connects 2 desert tortoise wildlife linkage areas, the fact that it's between 2 water areas and it could kill birds. They removed 77 desert tortoises from this area. And this photograph in the middle here is of Mojave yuccas, and they moved those when they build a giant substation for this project. But if you look at the hill there, which is south-facing, there are no other yuccas on the ridge there. And that means they put these yuccas, these are desert plants, but it's too low. And that means they're probably not going to survive. That's what I mean by adaptive management. They build these projects, think, how are we going to deal with it later? And then they don't really find a solution. This gunk right here is called cryptobiotic soil, and it's actually biological soil crust. It's very important in the desert. It actually stores carbon. The question is when you dig all that up, how much carbon disappears, and how good is that for climate change, and is there a better alternative to put these on rooftops? I live in Paw Valley, California, near Prim, Nevada, before 2010, after they built a power tower here. Here's another before. This is Clark Mountain in the Mojave National Preserve. This project was built about 3 miles from a national park. Here's after. And these are big, bright. There's three of these power towers there. They're not like solar panels. What they do, they have big mirrors that surround a central receiver tower. They focus the sun's heat and energy and light on this tower. Heats up water and turbines, it goes down, it spins conventional water turbines and creates electricity. The Ivanpah project is full of different impacts. It's 3,800 acres, 5 square miles. They removed about 12 habitat for 12 rare California desert plants. It has wildlife impacts, severe visual impacts. And this photograph in the middle shows some of the steam coming out. This project uses a lot more natural gas than they promised. It runs on about 30% natural gas backup to start up boilers and to compensate for when clouds pass over this project. The question is, were all these environmental impacts worth it? So here's some others. I'll try to walk through these. I'm sorry this PowerPoint got messed up on the iPad here. But we have another really interesting problem created by power towers. And it's called solar flux. First of all those mirrors attract birds, and that creates that lake effect. But when you're concentrating all of that heat and energy on one of these central receiving towers, you get this cone of electromagnetic radiation that's hotter than fire. And basically what it does, it can be up to 2,000 degrees, and it vaporizes birds. And we have the Ivanpah project with three of these towers killing about 3,000 birds a year, including a variety of raptors, wetland birds, roadrunners, all kinds of different critters, and or birds. It also kills insects, and the insects are believed to attract birds, so it's maybe an ecological black hole in that respect. On the top, we have the Nevada Crescent Dune Solar Project north of Tonopah, a single tower. And there's a halo above that tower, and they concentrated all of the mirrors and the heat above that halo in a standby position. And in January 2015, they filmed 130 birds getting vaporized in midair from that. The company decided that they would mitigate that, and you see this middle photograph here, and that's the tower in standby. And that's the solar flux diffuse, and that doesn't burn birds, it's not as hot. The question is, do they breed that? Do they get partially injured? Do they go off and get eaten by predators? On the left side is a prairie falcon that was singed by this project in July of 2016, taken to a wildlife rehab center, and you can see the wings are just gone. It's not dead, but it'll never fly away, and this is this chronic wasting of tissue caused by this solar flux. How do they mitigate it? Hey, they diffuse it. They've had other ideas. They're going to emit this stuff called bird buffer. It's a grape juice extract that puts out a vapor and scares birds away around the tower. BrightSource, the company, even said, we're going to put out decoy owls. That's on here. Can you imagine what a bird's going to think when it sees a plastic owl melted all over one of these mirrors? I don't know. So, desert tortoise is another issue. Ivanpah Valley is a very hot spot, and they removed 140 tortoises. They said there would only be 25 on the site. That was undercounted. It's a linkage area for tortoise. Another project here, right after, right next to its photovoltaic state line, in the middle there is a desert tortoise. That's before, and this is approximately, these are not the same location. I couldn't get in the same location because all of the projects are now surrounded by fences. I can't get in there, but they're all approximate. And that's what it looked like after they graded it. So they had to dig up all those tortoises, move them over the fence, and get them out of the way. And that doesn't count for all the unendangered animals like the kangaroo rats and everything else. The state line project saw a lot of desert tortoise mortality, where tortoises actually pace the fence and they overheat when they're looking for their old home. They put these little shelters around the fence, which actually work. But some of the tortoises aren't so lucky, and the coyotes get them. That's a common problem when you move and translocate tortoises. So Silver State, this is the final one, and I'm just about done. Ivanpah Valley, just on the Nevada side, the whole area is on the state line. If you look at this photo, it's a little faded, but above the power lines across the valley is the alluvial fan of a mountain range called the Lucy Gray Mountains. On the bottom of that is this little casino tacky town called Frim, Nevada. But the project they built about 6 years later is about four times bigger than Frim, Nevada. And that's all photovoltaic panels. And right below that you can see Frim. Now, right above that is what they left for the tortoises. They left about one-third of the area for those tortoises to use as connectivity. Tortoises don't go and walk that whole thing in one thing. It's generation after generation. But they want to keep that open for wildlife linkage. And for big solar, for solar panels that can go on rooftops, they cut that down by a third. Is that a wide use of solar energy? Other issues I didn't talk about because the slide didn't come in here. Down in Riverside County is the Genesis Project, and that was fast-tracked so much that they dug up an entire archaeological village without really consulting with the Colorado River Tribe, and it created a massive outcry about big solar in that area. The federal government still approves and builds these projects, but a lot of people don't like those. So I think that's going to be all I say. Keep it on the rooftop. On our website, we have the alternatives. Sorry.
I'm going to talk about all of the issues that everybody talked about, except for solar, maybe. Max talked about the dryland forests. Jennifer talked about the Air Force. You talked about the military and Air Force as well, and needs. Renewable, Jennifer talked about. I'm sorry. I'm going to talk about the Red Rock Biofuels Project. I'm a writer, like I said, and a homemaker. You can follow me along if you want. I've written two pieces on Counterpunch for this. One of them is called Scorched Earth, Military Forest Fuels in Oregon, and the other one's called Green Collaboration. And that's what I want to talk about today, is green collaboration. Jennifer, any big greens helping you with your issues?
Sierra Club tries to, but I don't really.
How about you guys? Big Green helping you guys at all?
No.
How about you, Max? All right.
Not too much.
I'm angry. I'm an angry guy. Okay, and it shows from my writing. Okay. Max, this isn't. I guess I need to do this. But what is the theme of this conference? It's one cause, one voice, right?
Yeah.
So, let me see if I can do this. I'm not even going to do this, as far as this, because I only have a few minutes. Well, there it goes. Lakeview, Oregon. Anybody ever been there? Mm-hmm. Anybody been to Heart Mountain? Anybody been to Sheldon? How about High Rock? You know, Steens? How about Burney, California? All right, a lot of people have, but I mean, Eastern Oregon is the Great Basin. It's an awesome place. I love it. Lived in Lakeview, the Warner Mountains. It's a great place. So, Lakeview, Oregon has the Ruby Pipeline that runs through it. Anybody know what the Ruby Pipeline is? Ruby Pipeline is a gas pipeline that drains the fracking fields of Colorado and Utah that Big Green allowed to happen. And even Middle Green, Western Watersheds, I've been all over them because they took money to allow the Ruby Pipeline to come through. And the Ruby Pipeline is being used for projects like the Red Rock Biofuels Projects and others to feed these industries along the Great Basin. I have looked at that Ruby Pipeline. I viewed it as the Grand, as the Glen Canyon Dam. It's Western Watershed's Glen Canyon Dam. And they don't want to talk about that because they got money. Onda, too. You think that Onda is like, you know, some great thing. It's not. They took money in order to have this Ruby happen. So what's the Red Rock Biofuels project? I'm going to read. I'm shaking because I get mad. And I try to write this stuff out so I don't shake. One of the largest deforestation projects in the United States is about to commence under the name of Renewables. Right, designed for the largest emitter of carbon on the planet, which is the military, Department of Defense, in this case, Air Force, providing private venture capitalists with $75 million in taxpayer subsidies to produce biofuels under guaranteed contracts.
Under what contract?
Guaranteed. So the military has paid a private group of people to take 350,000 tons of woody biomass, juniper trees, under the guise of wildland fire management. So in other words, reducing the wildland fire risk in the wildland-wildland interface, and for cattle, right? Because cattle degrade the Great Basin environment so much that you end up with these encroachments, these stream problems. They call them encroachments, and there are some encroachments in riparian areas. I'm not talking beyond that. But what they want to do is cut it. They want to cut this stuff down, truck it to Lakeview, and turn it into 15 million gallons of biofuels a year. And they want to truck this stuff along, bomb trains through Native people's lands, and to market for the Air Force to diversify their fuels portfolio. They've got a Nevada, now there were three projects that were all promoted as part of the Department of Air Force Advanced Drop-In Biofuels Program. And so there's one over in just outside of Fallon that's Fulcrum Energy, and they take grease from the casinos and such and turn it into biofuels, not forests. Seems kind of okay and more renewable to me. But let me go through. Let me back up here because I've only got a bit of time here. So there are a variety of problems here with this. Now, one. I have tried to get Big Green, Little Green, and everybody involved with this process from the beginning. And the beginning means, back for me, back in 2009, when a bunch of when I was living in Lakeview, and some citizens asked me, "Hey, can you help with this?" And it was to deal with not only biomass but also air quality. Okay, and the air quality issue with Lakeview is people are burning wood in their fires and their wood for heat. They're poor people. They burn wood for their heat. They have inversions, 30 degree below zero on occasion, and they're out of compliance for wood 2.5, PM 2.5. I tried to sue. I wrote a petition to the EPA to say, you're not with NAAQS. NAAQS says 3 years straight, National Ambient Air Quality Standards, 3 years straight, you fail, you're in. I wrote a petition. Nobody picked it up except for the NEDC in Portland, National Environmental Defense Center, but nobody was willing to take it that next step. Okay, EPA came up with a rule with a program called ADVANCE that essentially says, Lakeview, you come up with a plan to deal with your issues, and we will forego making you a non-designated, non-attainment area. And why does a non-attainment area matter? For 20 years, Lakeview has been trying to get biomass into town. Lakeview is a timber town. They cut all the timber down. All that's left are small diameter trees and drylands forests. For 20 years, an environmental group by the name of Sustainable Northwest, run by Jane O'Keefe, and her husband is head of the Oregon Cattlemen's Association, John O'Keefe, and have tried for 20 years to sell this whole idea of biomass to jobs. That somehow Lakeview can turn their small diameter mill and all of these forests, this mismanaged forest around them, and put people back to work gathering this forest, taking it into Lakeview, and at first it was to burn for electricity. Iberdrola Renewables is based in Portland. They are the largest renewable company in the world, based out of Spain. Their North American operations are in Portland. Wyden loves them. So if you think that Ron Wyden's some kind of environmentalist like these big greens, he's not.
We never did.
He's interested in bringing home bacon. If you go online and look up Ron Wyden and biomass, you will see him defending. He said, I will do everything in my power to stop the Obama administration's rules on biomass. Everything. He's not an environmentalist.
What's the name of that company in Portland again?
Iberdrola Renewables. Iberdrola, I-B-E-R-D-R-O-L-A. It's a Spanish company. Now, Red Rocks, so I got the EPA involved with this, I got NADC involved with this, I got Oregon Wild, thankfully they got involved with this. There were a few other groups that got involved, but then none of them were willing to go that next step, okay? So then all of a sudden Red Rock came into town. And Red Rock came into town and said, we're going to do this, and Iberdrola is going to do this. We know you got these air quality issues. DEQ even issued an air quality permit for Iberdrola's project that allowed them to pollute while citizens were fined for burning wood in their wood stoves during non-attainment times, during red air bans. What's that? That's what the NAAQS is supposed to do, right? Essentially say, put back your better. Best available control technology on your stacks or better. If you're in this attainment category, well, weren't supposed to do that. Wyden helped with that, okay? Because you had 20 years of institutional inertia with two important political people, one of which is considered a Democrat, and that's Jane O'Keefe and her Sustainable Northwest that pushes this restoration through the lack of natural processes. Let's go in and mechanically take care of it. And it's all for cows. And in part, also for fire, under the guise of fire and the wildland wild. And that's no good. Now, ultimately, so I've already said, one, there's players that are not green. Big green? None of the big greens wanted to touch this after it went to the NEPA process. So, Red Rock came, we went through the NEPA process, they had the scoping documents out. Some of the Greens got involved. The Wilderness Society wants nothing to do with it because they're part of the collaborative. Everybody know what these forest collaboratives are? These BLM collaboratives where they try to take ranchers, loggers, miners, and then have a few token environmentalists on there that want to cooperate, right? Like the Wilderness Society. The Wilderness Society signed on to this thing. The Lakeview Stewardship Unit is the oldest cooperative in the country. It's been around since the 1950s, they've been at it. And so the Wilderness Society and Andy Kerr from Oregon Wild, who promotes this kind of crap, who comes off as being some kind of environmentalist, he is part of, both are part of this collective, this cooperative. I said to Mike Anderson of the Wilderness Society, you guys going to come out against this facility now that it's here? Well, we don't care about that. What do you mean? You're only concerned about the head of the dragon, not the tail? And so, every major environmental group has essentially said, we are not going to litigate. And part of the reason that they say they're not going to litigate, I'm sorry, Jennifer, is because of Indian peoples. Okay? Now, the Red Rock Biofuel site, the EA, was site-specific for the 54-acre footprint of the site alone. This bullseye, that's where they want to get all the forest. And that was not part of any kind of EA. That was not part of any kind of NEPA compliance. Okay? What they also don't tell you inside EA is that they can, they do, but I forced them to, which was, you can make your product off natural gas. You don't even need biomass. Right? It's a bait and switch. To suck off the ruby forever. And they're using subsidies, $75 million worth of politics, to get it to happen over 20 years of inertia. And why is it the big green's not involved? Because they don't know where the hell Lakeview is. You know, a few people have been to Heart Mountain, but how many people have been to the tip of the top of the Warners? And so they don't know. It's another place no one knew, just like Elliot Porter's book when it comes to the Glen Canyon and the place no one knew. And that's what the Great Basin's been all along, is a place no one knows. So I'm just here to say, I'm sorry. I think everybody should be mad. I think everybody should get out and just get in I don't know. What's to say? I'm trying to do my part. I'm a homemaker first. I'm thankfully, my wife allows me to stay home, take care of kids, and write. Thankfully, I've been able to act locally and think globally, like everybody should. Okay? You know, which everybody here is trying to do in their own projects and such, right? And I'm thankful that I've been able to start writing about these things, getting these things out into the public's eye. And I'm, and from that, Max says, come here and talk to you. But I tell you, we don't have one voice. We don't have one cause. This is a project for the largest carbon emitter on the planet to produce unlimited amount of fuels from the fracking fields that supposedly all these environmental groups, Big Green and such, were against, right? You know, and in Colorado and Wyoming, and they're not. And so I guess what I want to leave you with is I'd like to see PILC being used as a way to come up with an environmental congress where people can get on the same page to be able to say, we agree with these things, and for other groups to say, well, we don't, so that they can be outed for what they are. So how many people in here are members of the Wilderness Society, the Sierra Club? You going to give your money anymore? Because they certainly didn't help Lakeview.
They helped me.
Well, I'm glad.
Maybe I can help you.
Well, but, you know, I'll tell you, you know, I don't know who you are, but I got a telephone call from Mary Adelman. She started the League of Conservation Voters back in the 70s.
Oh, yeah.
And she was talking at that time, boy, you know, what's going on in Lakeview? What's going on in Lakeview? And her concern was the Oregon Environmental Council. And they're not on board with anything. And she says, well, I'm going to take my money and go somewhere else. That's what it's going to take for us to get the work done, because Big Green's not going to do it for us. And neither are a lot of the Little Greens, because they're all neoliberal. They all need money. They all work off that system. They're all willing to be co-opted. And can I tell you one last secret? My wife is a district manager for the BLM. What do you think that our house is like? I do this with her all the time. She loves me. I'm lucky. But we need to do this to be green. And hopefully we can still stay in love, although I want a divorce. Thanks.
Well, thanks, everyone. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
We're a little over time, but nobody's coming in and kicking us out. So maybe we can do a few minutes of question and discussion. If that's okay with you all? Okay.
I have a question for the Nellis expansion. A national wildlife refuge. So because they're not doing any direct bombing, they're not required to plan to move the bighorn sheep or the tortoises? Or how does that work?
Yeah, they don't need to move them, but that was the refuge for the bighorn sheep. And so there's no place to move them to, really. And so military just claims I don't even know what their mitigation is for this. I don't think they've come up with it. They just are pretty sure they're going to get this land. They'll fly over, and that won't cause any stress to lambing sites, for example.
Right.
But no, they don't have any plans to move tortoises or sheep or golden eagles.
So it's delisting. I mean, it's no longer going to be National Wildlife Refuge.
Yeah, it will be. There's a technical process where it will be withdrawn, and then it'll be co-managed a little bit by the refuge people. But I was talking to one of the biologists, Fish and Wildlife Service biologists, and they will let the Fish and Wildlife Service bighorn sheep biologists have 20 hours a year to go in and check the sheep. 20 hours a year. So they're very concerned that they won't really be having enough time to even see how the sheep are doing. And the Nellis has a biologist, but they're not. Once it becomes absorbed into the DOD, we won't know what's happening.
And it's been an open refuge since 1936. And so that's a big deal. And there's, a lot of local people that are pretty pissed off that they're just going to lose their access to it as well. It takes a lot of nerve to try to do that. And it might happen under this administration, too. So.
I need to do something, if I can. I need to correct something, because I started to say something and I forgot. And I said, well, it's all Native people. They screwed it up. Well, they didn't. Okay. with Red Rock, the issue is, and I want to clear this up, in that the EA is specific to a 54-acre site, of which is a village site for an Indian. It's an Indian village site. They went through and they found, they surveyed six sites, and in one site alone they found three pit houses and 10,000 artifacts in one survey site. And they've got six more, and they're going to dig it all up. And so I you know, part of the issue with the EA was there is no formal 106 compliance agreement and an MOU between the Pitt people, the Klamath people, and the Burns Paiute. None for any of this project in Lakeview, for all of these you know, artifacts and such. Now, the reason I said this in regard to Indian peoples is like there's a tribal council, and there are people. They're just like our government, and we've got Donald Trump in right now, but we're not all Donald Trump. And so the Klamath, none of the tribes have decided to litigate. I have money dedicated to me by a small green group to litigate this. None of the bigs would come with that. Not even WELOC here at U of O would go with this, unless I got Native peoples. If I got Native peoples to come on board, we could sue. And none of the Native peoples would come on board, the tribal councils. And 2 weeks ago, the tribal chairman of the Klamath people said, we're all against the Red Rock project, but we see it as a business opportunity. There's nothing racial about that, you know, in my view. So I just wanted to clear that up. I mean, I needed to say that for my own benefit, Jennifer, but also to say that this is a substantial impact among many that I forgot to mention because I had your gracious time. So, thank you.
You want to speak to the Rivian? Do you want to speak to the Rivian?
Well, it impacted 39 tribes between Opal, Wyoming, and Lakeview or Mellon. But you know, this is the era of compensatory mitigation, and it's like what the tribal leaders choose to do doesn't necessarily reflect the views of the public. So, yeah, what we're looking to do, at least now, is set up our own nonprofit, you know, and achieve standing so we can enter our own protests, you know, with federal agencies.
Thank you for letting me do that.
Sure, no problem.
There's a question over here. Yeah.
Well, I live in California. I could get things done because I cooperated with not only build up big coalitions, but I work with the health community. And the health community is very much against biomass.
Right.
I don't know if you know that.
The American Lung
Association has been very outspoken about.
They're leading the charge, the health community,
yeah, they
is
are.
Against biomass.
But getting the medical community to come out and testify, people listen to the medical community. And they don't do that any place but in California, I've experienced.
I agree, and I've tried to do the same in places like Lakeview, and none of them will because they won't have customers.
Well,
not because of illness, but because they'll be shunned within the communities.
Oh, that's sorry to hear that. But, you know, people don't understand that biomass is worse than coal for emissions, and that cancer is increasing. Almost one in two people now have cancer. I have four kids. Three of them have had some sort of cancer. I haven't, but three of my four kids. And so I know it's a growing problem in our society, a deadly problem for many.
Right on.
And biomass is certainly produces a lot of cancer. I don't have any statistics on it, but the American Lung Association knows about it. And I first became acquainted with cancer and air emissions back in the 60s, way back. And I was shown the tumors that were produced by high sulfur particulates. And that isn't even biomass, which is really very high, much higher than coal. So I think we have to get the medical community more responsible for this.
I'm with you. And one thing that you're not mentioning as well is that carbon-wise, right? I mean, you know, beyond human health, the question is are we going to exist?
That's a higher question.
And so the idea that forests, these old growth, largest contiguous old growth forests left in the left in the United States, right? These dryland forests. The idea that we're going to cut them down and then release this carbon, and that somehow they're renewable, it's not.
No.
Particularly would we need to use them as a sink.
Well, the EPA came out again saying they said it was not renewable.
No, that's not true in a part, because Jen Merkley helped reverse the Clean Power Plan's strict language regarding biomass. It wasn't Wyden this time. It was Merkley and Collins. Both of them sent letters to the EPA when they came up with the CPP to specifically exempt biomass, so that each of the states who have to develop their own carbon plants could account for biomass as renewable. And that was how green our congresspeople are,
and
right?
Merkley,
you know, Merkley and Wyden both. And what is it about? It's about bringing home the bacon. The things that the politicians want to do is be reelected, and how do they do that? They claim credit for doing things, normally bringing home jobs.
The chamber runs the state.
Well, regardless, science should be running things.
Well, it doesn't.
It does not.
It's interesting, too, because in Europe, biofuels are huge. And most people don't realize this. You know, we hear these glowing articles about Germany has achieved, you know, such and such percentage of green power. What they don't tell you is that the largest percentage of that comes from biomass.
In the Southeast United States.
A lot of that is forest.
The Southeast United States is the largest
South Carolina.
Exporter.
Yeah. They're cutting up forests in the United States,
right,
turning them into pellets,
right,
shipping them across the ocean, burning them in Europe in power plants, and calling that green power, and calling that carbon neutral.
And cheating trees to boot.
My friend Derek Jensen came up with a great way of talking about that, which was carbon laundering. This is just like money laundering.
Yeah, right.
It's carbon laundering. And these are the sort of things that are being written to the Paris Climate Accord and all these agreements as being green and being carbon neutral, even though the science is...
They try to say that we use waste wood here in Eugene. This isn't waste wood. You can go see the log every day being taken into the biomass plant. It's really disgusting. Yeah. Hmm. Of course, I just disappeared.
Any other questions? Okay, well, thanks for coming, everyone.
Thanks for everyone.
Appreciate it.